This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. When President Obama's My Brother's Keeper initiative was first announced in February, it emphasized its goal to improve opportunities for young men of color. In the months that followed, the program's task force has met with public and private organizations that work with these young men to gauge recommendations, and last month it put out a call for mentors in communities across the country. Yet as it's made incremental progress, the initiative has also come under fire. Last week, senior Obama aide Valerie Jarrett responded to criticism that the program excludes young women of color. Now, two economists are saying My Brother's Keeper focuses too much on the behaviors of young men and is essentially blaming the victims rather than addressing the real structural causes of racial inequality. Dr. William Darity is a professor of public policy studies, African American studies, and economics at Duke University. Dr. Derek Hamilton is an associate professor at the Milano, the New School of International Affairs, and a research fellow at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. They join contributor David Pate in the studio for the latest installment of Real Talk. Hamilton begins by telling Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce that the initiative's error is emblematic of a society that wants to minimize the impact of discrimination.
We're in a paradigm that moves us away from discourse on racial inequality with the use of exceptions of black success and other anecdotes that, you know, the term that is commonly used now is post-racial. So that we say that there might be barriers that were a legacy that lead to poverty, but beyond that, discriminatory effects associated with race are marginal or non-existent.
Yeah.
And so that's the paradigm.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've heard someone say, well, you know, look at how wealthy LeBron James or Oprah Winfrey is. Mm-hmm. Well, there can't be any barriers to success for black folks in America now.
Where do we see that? I mean, you've given us a great example there, but where else do we see that? I mean, maybe at the policy level that's really impacting whether we're actually addressing these racial inequalities.
From the White House itself. Seems like all of the ideas that are aimed at addressing racial inequality aren't aimed at addressing structural things like discrimination, but rather attitudes, norms, and behaviors amongst blacks themselves or other subaltern populations themselves. The most prominent one right now is My Brother's Keeper, which is really trying to make, you know, it's not aimed at addressing labor market discrimination, but rather making black boys become better black men.
Yeah, the whole issue of respectability, of the politics of respectability, seems to be very prominent in My Brother's Keeper. And I really appreciate the fact that you did bring that into your most recent article in Dissent about the whole idea that we're not addressing the issue of the keeper, we're addressing the issue of the victim in terms of this whole blaming the victim mentality that started in the 60s. And did you want to kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, yep. Explain this a little further. So the idea here is that we're blaming people for their behaviors, how they manage their money, choices that they make, versus looking at real issues like structural
exactly.
racism and a lack of
yes.
perhaps opportunities, a lack of historic wealth gathering.
Yes.
Yeah, so I would like to talk about the phenomenon of discrimination and its ongoing significance. The first thing I want to observe is, you know, people frequently make the claim that there's an oppositional attitude towards education that is held by many blacks. But if you look carefully at what the evidence is, if you take into account any black individual's household socioeconomic status, that is the income and education of their parents, that black individual is more likely to get more years of schooling and more credentials than a white individual who comes from a family with a similar set of resources. So for given family resources, blacks actually demonstrate more of an achievement orientation with respect to education than whites do. Now, that's the first observation I want to make. The second is that the payoff for educational attainment remains lower for blacks than for whites. One key example is associated with the fact that at each level of educational attainment, the black unemployment rate nationally is twice as high as the white unemployment rate. And the unemployment rate for blacks who have some college education or an associate's degree is higher than the unemployment rate for whites who have not completed high school. One last comment, which is specific to the state of Wisconsin. A sociologist, Deva Pager, did a field experiment, and she conducted the field experiment in the city of Milwaukee, and she found that white males with a criminal record were more likely to get a callback for a job than black males with no criminal record when they are of a similar age and similar educational status.
So, you know, we have examples of the rhetoric around inequality that if people would take more responsibility, take initiative, don't seem to support the empirical data. And unfortunately, a lot of the policies that are coming about are aimed at or based on the rhetoric and not on the realities of really what's driving inequality.
If we're turning these kinds of thought processes on their heads, if we need to stop blaming the victim, as so many of these policies are based on, what then is causing this inequality?
The key indicator that needs a lot more attention is wealth. The resources that wealth give you allow you opportunities in the labor market, allow you opportunities to generate education, allow you basically access and opportunity to almost any field of human endeavor. And if we look at initial wealth, we can see that the racial inequality is most disparate in that outcome. Right?
What do we mean when we say wealth, though?
So net worth, what you own, your asset, it goes beyond income. Income is a flow that you get periodically. Wealth is a stock, your savings. Especially in a capitalist society where capital becomes more important, it is your accumulated resources. That's what we mean by wealth. So a technical definition would be the total value of your assets minus the total value of your debt.
And what do we look like currently as a country in terms of, if you look at the racial wealth gap, I've heard that term, people have heard that term, and you guys have talked about that term. So how would you, for our audience, how would you define what that looks like? I don't know if everyone understands when they hear racial wealth gap. How does it really look between a black, white, or Latino, whoever, whatever, however you want to explain it today?
What it looks like is complete disparity. The typical black household has about 6 cents for every dollar as a typical white household. The absolute wealth gap exceeds $100,000. And if we look at things like, suppose we exclude home ownership and just look at liquid assets, so the ability to get resources in a fairly quick manner. If we look at that, blacks are virtually penniless. The typical black household has $25 in liquid assets when you exclude retirement savings. If you add retirement savings, the figure goes up to $200. Now, we know that $200 can do very little if you're faced with a financial crisis or any type of emergency. In comparison, the typical white household has about $23,000 when you include retirement savings and $3,000 when you don't include retirement savings, which is over 100 times the amount that the typical black household has. So the disparities are stark. And then I mentioned earlier that we're in a paradigm where we like to believe that we've overcome race and to a large extent, that there's no real structural barriers holding groups behind because we turn to exceptionals like the president himself and say, well, a black man became president, so there's really not much barriers holding black people back. So consistent with that type of narrative, the explanations become, well, black people don't save. Well, black people are short-sightedness, or they make poor choices. They choose the wrong investment. But the prevailing wisdom from the economics literature with regards to savings is that once you control for income, if anything, black households have a marginally higher savings rate. Not a large amount, but if anything, they would save more than your typical white household. And again, that's controlling for income. So let me just conclude real quick because I'm being long-winded. But basically, the rhetoric does not support the reality. And again, the problem is that policies are directed at the rhetoric and not the reality. If we really want to address structural racial inequality, we need policies to address the reality.
So the idea of improving financial literacy among blacks, that doesn't seem to actually address what the problems are here.
First of all, the notion that improving financial literacy would close the racial wealth gap presumes that everyone is receiving similar amounts of inherited resources across generations. And that's not the case. In fact, the inherited inequalities are actually aggravated not only by differences in the amounts of resources that people receive when their relatives die, but also the amounts of resources that are transferred to them from their relatives while the relatives are still living. there are vast racial differences in the amounts of resources that get transferred across generations. And that accounts for most of the racial wealth gap, not poor savings decisions or ignorance on the part of blacks who are attempting to accumulate wealth. That's not the key issue. I would say this, you know, that the real issue is not financial literacy, but the lack of initial finance.
One thing you both said that I find intriguing, because I'm in this kind of a poll with my family members, we talked about this issue of home ownership. So we wanted to see amongst our own relatives under the age of 50, who had their own home, you know, and to see, are most people renting? Because we never really thought about it. And between 100 people, only 4 people in my family own their home, me being one of them.
You know, black people peaked in home ownership prior to the collapse in the mortgage market. And that peak was still well below the white home ownership rate. At the peak, we owned about close to 45%. That was the typical home ownership rate for families, a little under 45%. Now it's about 41%. In comparison, I believe the white rate hovers around 70 or 72%, something like that. That's on a nationwide basis. Most Americans, period, have the largest stock of their wealth and assets is home ownership. What's really underneath inequality in wealth is not necessarily home ownership per se. It is access to capital to purchase an asset that's going to appreciate over time. And it doesn't necessarily have to be home ownership. So again, let me try to make this point a little clearer. When people are young adults, you might have some groups of individuals that have access to some type of endowment either through inheritance or, as Sandy mentioned earlier, an in vivo transfer that allows them to purchase an asset that's going to appreciate over their lifetime. Other individuals don't have access to that capital to purchase that asset, whether it's home ownership, stock ownership, purchasing a business, or what have you. It is the security in an asset that's going to appreciate over a lifetime that really gives you economic security. You know, we like to think, and the rhetoric is, well, it's those individuals who are better savers, those people who take income and put it aside. Well, I'd say that that's a little misleading. What it really is getting into the ownership game of some asset.
And that's hard to do if that isn't being passed down from generation to generation to begin with.
That's exactly right. That's one of the key sources of structural inequality. So if we want policies to lead to a society where we really have at least close to a meritocracy, then we really have to arm individuals with some chip so that they can play in the game of capitalism. If you have no chip in the game, then you're basically structured for low levels of resource accumulation.
So what policies can we put in place to give everybody that chip to begin with?
For quite a while, Derek and I have been talking about a proposal that we call the Baby Bonds Initiative. The idea is that the federal government would provide each newborn infant with an endowment or a trust fund at the time of their birth. And the amount of the endowment or trust fund would be adjusted or graduated on the basis of the wealth position of the child's family. For children who are born into families at the lower end of the wealth distribution, we'd give them a $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund at the point of their birth. And these would be funds that could be accessed by the young people at the point where they reach adulthood, say age 18 or so. If we decided as a society collectively that we wanted to limit what they could do with those funds, perhaps constrain them to be used for educational purposes or to assist them in starting their own small business, we could do that. But the idea is to give each child an initial foundation or basis for having the capacity to acquire the types of assets that Derek was talking about earlier that would give them the capacity to have a decent wealth position over the course of their lifetime.
I can't imagine, given our current Congress that seems obsessed with austerity measures, that this would be something that would actually catch on, though.
Well, this wouldn't be that expensive, actually, in the grand scheme of things. Suppose you had 4 million babies that are born in a year. If the mean amount of the trust fund was $20,000, then the cost of the program for the initial cohort would be $80,000. I'm sorry, $80 billion.
That would be really cheap.
That would be really good. $80 billion. But $80 billion is actually not a very large share of the overall federal budget.
You've been talking about rhetoric, and one of the things I hear a lot is, well, this is an issue about class. This isn't an issue about race. Is that dangerous to use that line of thinking when we're looking at some of these inequalities?
Well, I'd say it's just inaccurate. There is a class dimension to the wealth gap, without a doubt, but there's also a racial dimension, which is even larger than the class dimension. We know it at every level of class. If you look at income by quintiles or deciles, we know that the racial wealth gap is enormous. So within income class, you find that Black and Latino households have a mere fraction of what their white peers would in that same income class. I'll give you another statistic that is very, I think, enlightening to the dimension of race. We know that head of households who graduated from college that happen to be Black, their family's wealth position is typically lower than families whose head of household is white and dropped out of high school.
Wow.
So clearly class cannot explain the dimensions of inequality by race with regards to the wealth gap.
Yeah, actually, the wealth gap gets worse as you move down the income distribution.
Yeah, but again, we've proposed solutions. So we recognize that there are asset-poor white individuals that would be beneficial if they had access to capital at a key point in their life to build their assets.
Yeah.
So we've categorized programs which John Powell at University of California, Berkeley has called targeted universalism. They're universal, but they're targeted at addressing structural inequality.
Sandy, Derek, David, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having this show.
Dr. William Sandy Darity is a professor of public policy studies, African American studies, and economics at Duke University. Dr. Derek Hamilton is an associate professor at Milano, the New School of International Affairs, and a research fellow at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. The pair co-authored the report Beyond Broke, Why Closing the Racial Wealth Gap is a Priority for National Economic Security. It's published by Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative. They'll also publish an article entitled From a Tangle of Pathology to a Race Fair America in the summer 2014 issue of Dissent magazine. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce and Real Talk contributor David Pate, who is an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. Coming up next, a better way to resolve conflict. A Milwaukee company believes it has an answer. We'll hear about it next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.